By now you know what earned my anger. Don't question it. Remind yourselves often of the impenetrable ignorance of the Irish and the English, their mass perpetuation of mutual misery. Remember the bloody hand of Libya with its training camps for terrorists and the free weapons. How could I suffer such fools to live? John Roe O'Neill, Letter 2. Most of the Huddersfield's top staff and researchers were being gathered in the administration building's executive lounge for the morning meeting with Rupert Stoner. People trooped along the walks, their umbrellas pointed dangerously ahead, keeping to the covered passages where they could to avoid the light rain that had set in about daylight. Stoner had arrived 40 minutes early, requiring Wycombe Finch to phone ahead to his assistants and to Beckett, then to dash back on foot from his working office. He arrived out of breath, his tweed jacket dark from the rain that had swept past his umbrella. Luckily, his assistants had laid on coffee and sweet rolls, and there was a brief interlude with Stoner, both of them recalling old times in public school. Why and Stoney. Wycombe Finch thought Stoner had not changed for the better since their upperclassmen days when they were preparing to be the privileged carriers of civilization's burdens. Stoner had been a chunky, ruddy-complexioned youth with unruly hair that tended toward dark sandy. He had had a rather blocky face with pale blue and coldly observant eyes. Stoner remained ruddy-faced, the sandy hair still unruly, although this now had more the look of a calculated effect. The eyes were even more chilly. Stoner's childhood nickname fitted him even better now. The blockiness had hardened. "We're gathering people in the lounge, Stoney," Wycombe Finch said. "Should be there by now. I've spoken briefly to Bill Beckett, and he should be along, too. The American chap." Stoner's voice was a deep baritone, which showed the marks of special training. "Quite a remarkable fellow, really," Wycombe Finch said. "Good at making our work understandable to others. Does he have anything definite to report?" "There it is," Wycombe Finch thought. He sensed the sudden stillness of his assistants at the table with the coffee and sweet rolls. He said, "I'll leave that to him."
"Expected to find you here in your office when I arrived," Stoner said. "I've a working office in one of the lab buildings," Wycombe Finch said. "Morning's a good time to get in my own contributions." "And what might your contribution be?" Stoner asked.
"I'm afraid this morning was rather taken up by a telephone conference with my opposite number in Ireland.
Doheny. Don't trust the bastard."
"Well, he did provide some interesting information this morning."
Wycombe Finch proceeded to recount Doheny's revelation about the suspected John Roe O'Neill.
"You give credence to that story?" Stoner demanded.
"The scientist always waits for the evidence," Wycombe Finch said. "Speaking of which, I think my people are all gathered now. Shall we go into the lounge?"
Wycombe Finch nodded to an assistant who led the way, opening the double doors ahead of the executives. The lounge was a softly unobtrusive space modeled after the smoking room of a London club, but larger. Dark wainscoting with a maroon print on black cloth above it circled the room, broken only by 4 windows, now closed by matching draperies, and a large marble fireplace in which a real fire flickered. There were deep leather chairs of glowing red-brown, a long refectory table of glossy mahogany to one side of the fireplace, and stand ashtrays on heavy brass pedestals. Light came from 4 chandeliers, which staff joked had been modeled after the spaceship in Close Encounters, and from a perimeter of wall-sconce spotlights focused on the table where Beckett had seated himself behind 3 neatly stacked report folders. Most of the other staff already was seated in chairs away from the table, obviously choosing not to be at the center of action.
"Word does get around," Wycombe Finch thought.
Beckett lifted himself easily from the chair as the party from the executive suite entered. There was some soft bustling around the room. A few throats were cleared. Beckett looked like a pink-faced schoolboy this morning, Wycombe Finch thought. Very deceptive appearance. There had been little time to brief him, but Wycombe Finch thought Beckett understood the delicacy of the situation. Wycombe Finch performed the introduction. Stoner and Beckett shook hands briefly across the table. Chairs for Stoner and the director were brought unobtrusively by assistants, who retired into the farther reaches of the room. 31 others had been assembled here, Wycombe Finch noted, counting silently. He made no move toward introductions. Later, perhaps. The curious were not gathering about this morning to meet with the powerful. He busied himself lighting the long-stemmed pipe while he took the chair beside Stoner. An ashtray appeared, as though by magic, thrust forward by a hand from behind. Wycombe Finch waved the assistant back, leaned his gold pipe lighter against the ashtray with grave deliberation. Then,
"Well, Stoney, I don't know how much you understand about our—"
"Why, let's not try the scientific mystery approach, eh?" Stoner said. Beckett leaned forward, his voice deceptively calm. The director's words were polite and to the point.
"Ah," Wycombe Finch thought, "Beckett has an object for his anger. This should be interesting, to say the least."
"Really?" Stoner's voice dripped ice chips.
"I would not have said it were it not real," Beckett said.
"Without knowing how much you understand about our work, we cannot begin to brief you. I will say at the outset that there's nothing wrong with being ignorant about our work. Guilt should attach only to anyone who remains ignorant in the presence of an opportunity to learn."
"Well said, old boy," Wycombe Finch thought.
Stoner leaned back in his chair, his face blank, only a slight throbbing at the neck to reveal his emotion.
"I've always heard Yankees were a cheeky and impetuous lot," he said. "Do proceed to remove my ignorance."
Beckett straightened. The pontifical approach was what this bastard needed, he thought. Get him off balance and keep him there. Wycombe Finch had said the man was weak in science, only fair in math. Stoner would have feelings of inadequacy. Beckett took his time opening the folders and spreading papers before him. "We're currently focusing on the enzyme-inhibiting characteristics of the disease," Beckett said. "You've no doubt heard about the Canadian team's work. We're particularly interested because the absence of an enzyme can lead to the absence of a particular amino acid, and a change in one amino acid out of some 300 of them can result in a fatal condition. We're certain O'Neill blocked certain amino acids by tying up the structures that make them."
"I've read the Canadian report," Stoner said.
"But did you understand it?" Beckett wondered. He said, "Good. Then you'll follow that we believe this plague causes a kind of premature aging, very swift. No time for many of the usual side manifestations. I call your attention to the white blotches on the extremities. Very suggestive."
"Genes to control aging?" Stoner asked, a sudden intense curiosity in his voice.
"Action of a gene is concerned with formation of a particular enzyme, which is a protein," Beckett said. "Genes control the amino acid makeup of specific proteins. Rendering certain DNA combinations incapable of producing particular amino acids can be a deadly disease."
"I hear mention of RNA as well," Stoner said.
"RNA and DNA relate to each other like a template and the finished product," Beckett said. "Like a mold and the casting that comes from it. The infected host manufactures protein dictated by the RNA. When bacterial viruses infect bacteria, RNA is formed that resembles the virus DNA and not that of the host. The sequence of the nucleotides in the new RNA molecule is complementary to that of the RNA of the virus."
"He transmitted this thing with a virus?" Stoner asked.
"He shaped new bacteria with a new virus. Very fine determinations in very fine structures. It was a superb accomplishment."
"I don't enjoy hearing praise for the man," Stoner said, his voice flat.
Beckett shrugged. If the man didn't understand, he didn't understand. Beckett said, "O'Neill created subcellular organisms, plasmids for their bonding characteristics, attaching them at key places in the recombinant process. Had it not taken such a twisted turn, his work would have qualified him for a Nobel. Pure genius, but driven by the dark side of human motivations.
Stoner let this pass. He said, "You mention nucleotides. Nucleic acids are the molecules upon which the coding is written. They direct the manufacture of proteins and hold the keys to heredity. Like proteins, nucleic acids are heavy polymers. I hear it rumored that you're finding fault with something called the zipper theory," Stoner said.
Wycombe Finch shot a hard glance at Stoner. So the man did have his spies in the Huddersfield establishment. Or on the telephone. DNA is a double molecule with one chain twined around the other in helical form, Beckett said. It is a flexed compound that turns and twists upon itself in a peculiar fashion. We think these flexings are extremely significant.
How is that?
Things that lock together do so according to their intrinsic shape. The twistings are a clue to that shape.
Clever, Stoner said. We think the thing may lock together more like your winter waterproof, Beckett said. First one set of connections, and then a second, overlapping set.
What kills this plague? Stoner asked. Besides fire, that is.
Intense concentrations of ozone seem to inhibit it. But the growth is explosive in both men and women. To say it is biologically active is to understate the case.
Stoner pulled at his lower lip.
What necessary thing does it lock up?
We think it blocks vasopressin, among other things.
Essential to life, eh?
Beckett nodded.
Is it true the plague kills hermaphrodites?
Stoner said hermaphrodite as though it were a particularly foul thing.
True hermaphrodites, yes, Beckett said. That's very suggestive, isn't it? I was thinking that the resultant society could be very male and very female. The hermaphrodites mostly weeded out.
He cleared his throat.
This is all very interesting, but I hear nothing new, really. Nothing indicating a dramatic insight.
We're still gathering data, Beckett said. For instance, we're running a parallel line of inquiry into some plague symptoms that are similar to those in neutropenia.
What?
Stoner asked.
Wycombe Finch stared at Beckett.
This was new.
Neutropenia, Beckett said, noting how Stoner's eyelids lowered in a speculative squint. Neutrophils are granular leukocytes, having a nucleus of 3 to 5 lobes connected by chromatin and a cytoplasm containing very fine granules. They're part of the body's first line of defense against bacterial invasion. It's a disease that can have a genetic origin.
He's being too technical for Stoney, Wycombe Finch thought, but the revelation was fascinating.
He said, "You got that from the Foss autopsy?"
Beckett was silent for a moment, looking down at the papers in front of him, but not seeing them. Then, "Ariana provided us with quite a number of clues before she died."
This was Dr. Ariana Foss, who worked with Bill and the others before the plague killed her,
Wycombe Finch explained to Stoner.
Stoner nodded, noting the pain in Beckett's expression.
Before she died, she gave us her own internal view of her symptoms, Beckett said. This plague kills with central nervous system breakdown and enzyme blockage. There is general degradation of functions and a final lapse into unconsciousness, with death following quickly.
"I've seen plague victims die," Stoner said. His voice was brittle.
"The disease process does not extend long enough," Beckett said, "for many symptoms to manifest. We're forced to interpret from only the beginning traumata, but Ariana gave us a finely tuned assessment of those."
Stoner spoke nervously.
"Very interesting."
Wycombe Finch took a deep puff on his pipe and pointed the stem at Stoner.
"Let's not forget, Stoney, that the plague was tailored for a specific effect. To kill only women, and to kill them quickly, despite medical efforts to the contrary." Stoner's tone was dry. I'm aware of the selectivity.
Remarkable achievement, Wycombe Finch said.
If we can leave this meeting of the Madman Admiration Society for a moment, Stoner said, I must say my ignorance has not been removed.
We're dealing with a remarkable code, Beckett said, equivalent to a highly complex combination of an extremely sophisticated safe.
O'Neill solved it, so we know it can be done.
It seems you've taken all this time to tell me you're faced with an extremely difficult project, Stoner said. Nobody questions that. What we're asking is, how close are you to a solution?
Perhaps closer than many suspect, Beckett said. Wycombe Finch sat up sharply.
Beckett glanced out into the lounge where Hupp sat placidly behind his thick glasses, his chair slightly ahead of those occupied by Danza and Lepikoff. All three were watching Beckett carefully, and, with this last utterance, attention of the entire staff was centered on Beckett.
That wild call from Browder to Hupp, Beckett thought. He could imagine the young man in the isolation chamber with his pregnant lady. Then the idea. How had he come by it? Both accurate and inaccurate, but the insight it ignited.
Wycombe Finch favored Beckett with a reserved stare. Stoner leaned forward.
Closer than we suspect. O'Neill demonstrated several things, Beckett said. The cell is not inviolate. He has shown that the cell's chemical fragments can be refitted, reshaped to carry out extraordinary processes. The living organization in the cell, that system which mediates the cell's operations, has been solved. We no longer can doubt whether this is achievable. The important thing, though, is that we also know now that genetically directed alterations in cell function need not stop with maturity. The neutropenia clue assures us that we can contract a new genetic disease as adults.
Stoner blinked.
Wycombe Finch continued to stare silently at Beckett.
Was this what the Americans called a snow job?
If some of the thousands upon thousands of chemical processes taking place continuously in each of our living cells are blocked, slowed, or otherwise removed, development of the organism is specifically altered, Beckett said. O'Neill has demonstrated that this is just as true after the development of complex, higher organisms as it is of the simpler forms. Massive alterations can be achieved. And he has shown that the system is subject to fine-tuning.
My word, someone out in the lounge said.
Wycombe Finch took his pipe out of his mouth, suddenly aware of what Beckett was implying. It was a two-way process. It was obvious once stated. Did Stoner have the slightest idea of what he had just heard?
I was briefed by a Home Office M.D., Stoner said. He sounded irritated, and the chill had returned to his eyes.
It's like a paper chase where not one scrap may be overlooked.
Stoner did not understand the implications, Wycombe Finch realized. It had gone over his head.
You've implied that you're close to the end of the chase, Stoner said.
Is that what I tell the Prime Minister?
He will ask me, how close are we?
We cannot tell yet, Beckett said, but we see the trail more clearly now. What O'Neill developed was a viral strain that carried a donor DNA message to the living human cell via an infected bacterial agent.
This spirochete thing the Canadians say they've detected, Stoner said.
Is that the disease?
My guess is that it's not. We think they're seeing a remnant, a breakdown product of O'Neill's plague, a mutation, perhaps.
Locked in the cell, Stoner muttered.
Like the overlappings of a maypole, Beckett said.
Maypole, Stoner said.
He nodded, obviously liking the concept. It would make an impression at the Home Office.
There's obviously a genetic series that dictates that a fetus will be female, Beckett said.
The plague locks into that sex-differentiated pattern and stays there long enough to create swift and general chaos.
Takes the old ball and carries it off the field, Stoner said.
Forgot he was a soccer fan, Wycombe Finch thought. Well put, he said. Beckett's tone was puzzled. The block, once formed, is remarkably strong.
It must be associated with more powerful chemical bonds. O'Neill identified repetitive satellite DNA processes in sufficient detail. He could pick and choose among them.
You really think you're close on his heels? Stoner asked.
I say what I believe, Beckett said, and he saw Hupp across the room nodding agreement.
Wycombe Finch, his teeth firmly clamped on the stem of the pipe, which had gone out, managed to look sage and wished he felt as confident as Beckett sounded. Stoner looked at the director, and there was suspicion in the look.
What do you say to all this, Wy?
Wycombe Finch removed the pipe from his mouth. He put it into the ashtray, bowl down, looking at it as he spoke.
We are convinced that O'Neill mated the two halves of specific portions within the DNA-RNA helix of the human genetic system. He did this in a binding way.
Here Wycombe Finch nodded at Beckett.
The two halves dovetail into an extremely powerful bond. Bill's team believes there may be independently replicating systems within that helical chain to form this bond.
And what do you believe? Stoner asked.
Wycombe Finch looked at Stoner.
They may have produced the most promising insight yet achieved.
May have, Stoner said. You're not convinced.
I'm a scientist, Wycombe Finch protested. I must see the proof.
Then why do you think their approach is promising?
It indicts the viral DNA, for one thing. We all know that has to be part of it, but also sketches clear steps into the cellular system.
I fail to see those steps, Stoner said.
The paper in this paper chase is the blocked enzymes, Beckett said.
Stoner flicked a glance at him, then back to Wycombe Finch. He had noted this comment, though, and it was obvious this would be replayed for the Prime Minister.
Viral DNA can be associated with bacterial DNA in a quite straightforward process, Wycombe Finch said. All progeny of the bacteria will contain the viral DNA and any messages written into that viral DNA.
Message, Stoner said, his voice blank.
It encounters that portion of the human DNA chain which dictates that the host be female, Wycombe Finch said. The viral DNA, we believe, then locks into that cellular substratum and dissociates from its bacterial carrier.
Message delivered, Beckett said.
But do you know how it does this? Stoner asked.
We can follow its trail now, Beckett said. We will begin to see the shape of it up ahead very soon.
How soon, damn it?
Stoner glared at Beckett. Beckett only shrugged. We're working on it as fast as we're able.
We're fairly certain of the conditions under which it reproduces, Wycombe Finch said. Not to forget that it proliferates in the presence of antibiotics.
We're getting impatient, Stoner said.
Right now your impatience is keeping us from our work, Beckett said.
Stoner pushed his chair back and lifted himself to his feet.
Would someone tell my driver I'm ready to go?
Wycombe Finch lifted a hand and saw an assistant get up hastily and leave the room.
Stoner turned and focused on Wycombe Finch.
You turn my blood to water, why? If I had my way, we'd come in here and absolutely burn out all of you. We'd sterilize the ground you walk on and then we'd try to start over.
Making the same mistakes all over again, Beckett said, coming around the end of the table.
Stoner turned his coldly observant stare on Beckett.
Perhaps not. We might make scientific research a lethal offense.
Turning away, he strode out of the room, not even glancing at the assistant who swung the door wide for him. Beckett stood beside Wycombe Finch, watching until the door closed behind Stoner.
"What do you suppose he'll tell the Prime Minister?"
Wycombe Finch asked.
"He'll say we have a new theory that may pan out, but the government must wait and see."
"You really think that?" The director stared hard at Beckett, then bent to the table and retrieved the pipe.
"Very scientific," Beckett said. "Wait to see the proof."
Wycombe Finch looked at his pipe while he spoke.
"Tell me, Bill, was that what you chaps call a snow job?"
"Not a bit of it." The director looked up and met Beckett's gaze.
"Then I do wish you'd briefed me before dumping it out like that. Especially the two-way implications.
Surely you don't question."
"Of course not. I'm just not sure I would have shared it with Stoney."
It went right over his head.
"Yes, I'm sure you're right about that."
Wycombe Finch glanced at the staff members who were slowly filing out of the room, none of them meeting the director's gaze.
"But he'll have his spies here, and one of them's sure to explain it."
"Then he'll know about the carrot as well as the stick.
Politicians don't like sticks in other people's hands.
Carrots either, for that matter." "We're quite excited by the implications," Beckett said. Wycombe Finch glanced at Hupp, still seated in the big chair. The room was almost empty.
"I do believe," the director said, "that Dr. Hupp is not as excited as you are, Bill. Dr. Hupp appears to be asleep."
"Well, what the hell," Beckett said. "We did work all night."
"Out of Ireland have we come. Great hatred, little room, maimed us at the start. I carry from my mother's womb a fanatic heart."
William Butler Yeats.
As they came down onto the central floor of the valley just before noon, John found it not as bad as it had appeared from the heights. Low hillocks lifted and fell beneath the road, some with cottages nestled into them. A few of the cottages had not been burned, but most of the windows were gone. Doors stood open. Not a sign of human life still here. The occasional barking of a dog fox could be heard back in the trees, and once, as they rounded a granite-girt corner, there was a frightened cackling of a hen, a glimpse of brown feathers darting into the roadside bushes. Jackdaws were nesting in many of the chimneys. One giant maple standing alone in a field was decorated with a flock of colored doves, spots a soft fawn gray speckled throughout the green. Vernal grass had taken over in many of the fields. Herity, walking beside John, sniffed the air and said, "There's a certain smell to human occupation that's gone from this valley." John stared at the backs of the boy and the priest walking about 20 paces ahead. They were separated by the width of the road, the priest on the left, his head bowed, the knapsack riding high on his shoulders. The boy sometimes darted to the middle of the road, glancing all around and occasionally bending his head to listen. The sound of their feet on the blacktop echoed between the road's rock-fenced boundaries. He began to look more closely at the empty valley around them, the blacktop winding through it, over the hillocks and around them. There was a penetrating loneliness to this region, more empty by far than any wilderness. He sensed that it came from the fact people had lived here. The people had been, and now they were gone. It was that kind of loneliness.
"What happened to this valley?" John asked.
"Who knows? A simple rumor can empty a village. Maybe there was a mob. Maybe they burned it and left. You hear stories now. A cure and women living in the next valley. Maybe men came here and found the rumor false."
"Are we taking the shortest way to the lab?"
"The safest."
"Ah," John thought, "the safest. Then Herity has knowledge of such things. Where does he come by it?"
The road wound its way around another hillock, and the way was open to a view of the trees along the river about a half mile ahead. Patchy cloud cover had let the sun shine through. A meadow glistening in the golden light on their left. Beyond it, elder trees stood thick along the riverbank, a tall hedge of them feeding on the flow of water.
The elders swayed and beckoned in a soft breeze. "Parnell came to hunt in this valley," Herity said. "He had English manners, he did. His middle name, you know, was Stuart, with the Frenchies spelling. Charles Stuart Parnell. The same as Jim Dung. James Dung Stuart." John marvelled at the way history was preserved here. It was not just the broad sweep of historical events and the dates of battles, but the intimate details. Parnell had hunted in this valley. And when James Stuart abandoned the Irish to their foes, the Irish had renamed him Jim Dung. That was 400 years ago, and there was still venom in Herity's voice when he uttered the name. And what of Parnell, whose dream of reform had been killed by English exposure that a mistress had borne him children? Parnell was reduced to English ways. "Joyce wrote a poem about those hills ahead of us," Herity said. John turned a sly look on Herity. "He wrote about Parnell, too."
"Ah, you're a literary man," Herity said. "You'd a grandfather who dreamed Irish dreams, or I miss my guess."
John felt a hollowness in his breast. He heard Mary's voice saying, "I still miss Grandpa Jack." There was confusion in his thoughts. "Whatever I say, Herity hears and interprets.
Wherever the Irish go, they take Ireland with them," Herity said.
They walked in silence for a time. The river was audible now, and they could see a stone bridge through a gap in the elders. Framed by the gap, there was a mansard roof and bits of stone walls far up ahead at the top of the valley. Herity, seeing the green-framed mansion, thought, "There's Bran MacRae's little dovecote. We'll soon see what this John O'Donnell's made of." The priest and the boy stopped at the near abutment of the bridge and turned to watch their companions approach. John walked out onto the bridge and looked downstream where water rippled over green rocks. The meadow visible through the trees sloped down to a narrow stretch of boggy ground beside the river. Valerian and yellow flags could be glimpsed in the marsh. Bees were working the meadow, but the river sounds masked their humming. The sun, the warmth, the river. A sense of relaxation settled over John. He accepted a slab of soda bread from the boy, a thin slice of white cheese on it. The boy put his elbows on the bridge's stone rail and watched the water while he ate. John could smell the perspiration of the boy, a sweet odor. The young cheeks moved evenly with the chewing. What a strange child, John thought. A personality attempting to be transparent. Not here. But he was here. He ate the food Father Michael gave him. He called attention to things by looking sharply at them. He nestled against the priest at times, a hurt animal seeking such comfort as he could find. And the attention he called to himself by his silence, discordant, a protest louder than any scream. "I do not speak." It was a thing repeated every time John looked at him. As a protest, it was remarkably irritating, especially to Herity. John looked at Herity and Father Michael standing there beside their packs at the end of the bridge, eating silently, not looking at each other. Herity occasionally glanced at John and the boy. Herity, slowly eating his soda bread and cheese, keeping an eye on the road they had traversed, studying the land around them, looking for anything that moved, anything with a thread in it. Wary. That was the word for Herity. He was as isolated as the silent boy, but the wariness was different. There. He had his pocket knife out again. Always manicuring his fingernails with that knife, meticulous and purposeful, an action like a habit. Cleanliness by rote. He had handsome fingers, too, long and slender, but with power in them. John had seen them flex like claws, the tendons standing out along the knuckles. The priest beside him, tall and haggard, very tall. A Hamlet in a dark suit, the black hat pulled low over his eyes. The features put John in mind of Horseface, that protruding jaw, the forward thrust at the neck, the strong nose, and the dark eyes beneath those heavy brows, those thick and powerful teeth slightly protruding. Not a handsome man, but it was a face not easily forgotten. The boy beside John coughed and spat into the river. John tried to imagine the boy happy, playing merrily, some fat on him. He had been a toddler once, animated with joy of life, running to his mother. Such things were back there somewhere. A sturdy lad. The flesh appeared healthy in spite of its emptiness. Dead, but not dead. Why did the boy irritate Herity so? Time and again John had seen Herity try to make the boy break that vow of silence. What good is such a vow? It won't bring back the dead. There was never an answer. The boy withdrew farther into his silent armor. The way he pulled his head into the blue anorak begged comparison with a turtle, but the comparison failed. The turtle might withdraw its vulnerable parts, staring out fearfully until danger passed. This boy cowered in some far deeper place than the hood of his anorak. So deep it was that the eyes sometimes had not a glimmer of life in them. Everything the boy did at such times was transformed into a sullen patience, far more stilled than mere silence. It was suspended animation, as though the life processes were put on hold while the flesh plodded along. The flesh remained merely the carrier of an inert spirit, a mass without internal direction. Except when he threw rocks at the rooks. Why did this boy hate the blackbirds so? Had he seen them settle onto beloved flesh? Perhaps that was the explanation. There could be bleached bones somewhere, cleansed by the birds, bones that once had carried someone this boy loved. John finished his soda bread and cheese, dusted his hand, and crossed the bridge to where worn, irregular stone steps led down to the water. Beside the stream, he knelt and scooped the cold water into his palms, drinking it noisily, enjoying the coldness on his cheeks. The water tasted sweet and faintly of granite. John turned his head at a sound beside him. The boy had joined him on the ledge beside the flow and was drinking with his face plunged into the current. Face dripping water, the boy looked up at John, a solemn, studying expression. Who are you? Should I be like you? In a sudden feeling of confusion, John stood, shook the water from his hands, and climbed back to the bridge. How could the boy speak so plainly without words? John stood at the bridge rail above the boy, not looking at him. There were low willows along the boggy ground beneath the elders. A cloud came over the sun then, throwing the world between the trees into a sudden chill gray. The river sounds were only river sounds, John told himself, not people talking. Once this land might have been enchanted, but now the spirits were gone. It possessed only this emptiness, an absolute vitiation at one with the gnarled willows beneath the elders and the dank bog at the river's edge. The river spoke to him, a blasphemous echo. My spirits are gone. I am wasted. The cloud passed, and once more the sun beat down between the trees, sparkling on the water. But it was different. The boy joined John on the bridge. The priest came to them, carrying his pack in one hand, leaving Herity at the end of the bridge, staring off across the meadows. This is desecration, Father Michael said. The boy looked up at Father Michael, a question plain on the silent young face. What does that mean? The priest met the boy's gaze. It's a terrible place. The boy turned and looked all around, his expression clearly puzzled, saying that he thought this a pretty place. The trees, the river, a full stomach. He's healing, John thought. Would he speak when he was fully healed? Herity, coming up to them, said, Ah, the priest's in one of his black moods. His faith is wavering in his mouth, and it like a faucet that lets everything run out. Father Michael whirled on him. Would you destroy faith, Herity? Ah, it's not me destroys the faith, priest, Herity smiled at John. "This great tragedy is what kills the faith. For once, you're right," Father Michael said. Herity pretended surprise.
"Am I now?"
Father Michael inhaled a deep breath.
"All the doubts that ever were are growing like weeds in the untended garden that was Ireland."
"What a poet you are, Father!"
Herity turned and met the gaze of the silent boy. "It's Shah's stony land you've inherited, poor lad, and you've not mind nor senses to see it."
A deep shuddering sigh shook Father Michael. "I think sometimes this must be a terrible nightmare, the white horse of all horrors. And we'll wake soon enough, laughing at the night's terrors, going on about our ways as before. Please, God."
The boy clutched his anorak around his throat and turned away from them, plodding off the bridge. Father Michael slung his pack onto his shoulders and followed. Herity glanced at John.
"Shall we be going along now?"
Almost imperceptibly at first, the road began to climb out of the valley. Herity, with John beside him, stayed closer to the priest and boy, no more than 5 paces behind.
Was it safer here? John wondered. Herity was not keeping them spread out. Or was it the sharp turns in the road around which nothing could be seen? Did Herity want to be closer to the priest and see with him what next the road revealed?
"Do you know what happened to our Father Michael there?"
Herity asked.
"Well, I can see he'll not be telling you, and him the best witness to it all."
The priest did not turn, but his shoulders stiffened. Herity addressed the stiff back, his voice loud.
"In the first days of the plague's terrible scything, a great maddened mob of men burned Maynooth in County Kildare. The whole place, even St. Patrick's College where Fitzgerald Castle once stood, and it a shrine to the old ways. The new block burned like a torch it did, and the old block came tumbling down to the big machines pushing it and the explosives. It was a sight to see."
"Why did they do it?"
"The terrible anger in them. God had abandoned them. They couldn't get at God, so they got at the church."
Herity lifted his chin and called out,
"Isn't that what you told me, Father Michael?"
The priest remained as silent as the boy walking beside him.
"The smoke rose to heaven for 3 days, Herity said, "and longer if you count the smouldering. Ah, the flames so high, and the mob capering about it and hunting priests to burn the while."
"They burned priests?"
"Right into the fire with them."
"And Father Michael was there?"
"Oh, yes. Our Father Michael was there to see all that capering. The priests had a fine store of drink in their cellars, they did."
John thought of the brand on Father Michael's forehead. "Was that when they branded him?"
"Oh, no. That was later. His own folk did that because they knew he'd been at Maynooth, and him still alive." "Ah, no. It was death for a priest to be seen there during the whole time of the burning."
Herity fell silent. Only the sound of their footsteps echoed between the road's rock boundaries, and there was a faint, murmurous praying from Father Michael.
"Listen to him pray," Herity said. "Remember how it was, priest?" "Ah, John, the burning of Maynooth could be seen for miles. The smoke of it went straight up, it did. I know a priest was there, and I heard him say it was a signal to God."
Only the low droning of prayer came from Father Michael.
"We saw the message to God, didn't we, Father Michael?" Herity called. "And what did we say?" "God can lie. That's what we said. God can lie to us."
John pictured the scene in Herity's vivid words. O'Neill within could be sensed there, listening, but not attempting to come out. The fire, the shrieks, he could almost hear them.
You were there with Father Michael, John said. Lucky for him. Saved his mangy skin, I did. Laughter bubbled from Herity. Oh, he doesn't like that, him owing his life to the likes of me. So many priests dying and him alive. It was a sight, I tell you. They kept no count, but it was over 200 of 'em burned, I'm sure. Into the fire and straight to hell. Father Michael raised his fists to heaven, but did not turn. His voice continued its murmurous prayer. Herity said, It was a fiery martyrdom, the likes of which has not been seen in this land for many a century. But our Father Michael doesn't have the stuff of martyrs. The priest fell silent. His movements looked weary. The pack on his back dragged at his shoulders. Some say only 12 priests escaped, Herity said. In Mufti, hidden by the few of us who kept our senses. Well, I sometimes wonder why I helped. But then it was a terrible stench, and the drink running out. No reason to stay. Herity smiled secretly to himself, then turned and winked at John. But the madman would have loved the sight of it. Of that I'm sure. John's step faltered. He could sense O'Neill within, hysterical giggling. Why had Herity said that? Why tell me? Herity had lowered his attention to the road at his feet, though, and his expression was unreadable. It was steeper here, the road climbing around hills that, when they opened to a view ahead, showed the way rising toward the tree-framed notch at the top of the valley. There was a damp, almost tropical heat in the afternoon air. John's senses wanted jungle and palms, not these green hills and this black, narrow roadway cutting like a sheep terrace into the land. The bracket of trees ahead was mostly European poplars, scrawny from fighting the winter storms that used the notch as their pathway into the forests and boglands to the east. The memory of Herity's words in his ears, John was taken suddenly by the oddity of the Irish relationship with this landscape. Why had Herity saved the priest? Because Father Michael had been born of the same soil. Something happened in this marriage of people and land. The Celts had got under the skin of Ireland. They did not move just across the surface of the land like nomads. Even this tramp was more through Ireland than across it. Herity's people had made themselves part of the very soil. There was never any question of them owning Ireland. Quite the contrary. Ireland owned them. John lifted his gaze to the path ahead. Behind the poplars could be glimpsed the deeper stain of evergreens clinging closely to the hillsides in neatly planted rows. There, within the deeper trees, lay the great house with its mansard roof, a French chateau appearing untouched above the ruins in the valley. Smoke lifted from its chimneys. The house nestled into the trees. It had been adopted by Ireland. No longer French. It was an Irish house. The smoke smelled of peat.